So now let us go on from our general dependence on words and letters to our dependence on them in purely spiritual matters. We have, we suppose, a certain amount of religious or spiritual knowledge. We might assume, we might take it for granted, at least some of us, that we know Buddhism. That is, we know the four truths. If we're asked, we can say, yes, truth of pain, origin of pain, cessation of pain, way to the cessation of pain. We know the Eightfold Path, right understanding, right aspiration, right speech, so on. We can read it off, we know it, we can explain it, we can even talk about it. We know, say, karma and rebirth, can explain how it works. We know nirvana, what that is. We know dependent origination. We know shunyata, the void. Oh yes, emptiness, know that too. Bodhisattvas, we know that. The Pure Land even, we know that. We even know about Zen. Now, where has this knowledge come from? Now it's all, or practically all come, 99.9% of it, from books and lectures and talks. Ultimately, we may say whatever is good and useful or valid in it on its own level comes from the scriptures, a survey of which was attempted last week. Now, the scriptures, of course, consist of words and letters. So, obviously, any knowledge derived from the scriptures is dependent on words and letters. In other words, it's second-hand knowledge, not direct knowledge, not knowledge by experience. Not personal to ourselves, but something borrowed, something derived. Like wearing someone's cast-off clothing which doesn't fit us, more often than not. So let's perform our experiment once again. Suppose we put aside all our knowledge of Buddhism that depends upon words and letters, which hasn't been experienced and verified for ourselves. Put it all aside. All that knowledge of Buddhism, that so-called knowledge, which is really not knowledge at all, just a reflection of what we've read or what we've heard. Discard it all. Probably, most likely, we'd have to discard quite a lot. To begin with, do we really know what nirvana is? As distinct from just reading something about it, hearing something about it, do we know? All right, if we don't put it aside, that so-called knowledge of nirvana, do we really know the workings of karma and rebirth? If we don't put it aside, what about shunyata? All right, put that aside too. So how much real knowledge of Buddhism is left when we put all this material aside, all this second-hand material? How much is there that is a matter of our own direct personal experience? Now we have to admit very, very little. Perhaps nothing at all. But even if there's nothing at all left, even if we come to the rather staggering conclusion that really we don't know Buddhism at all, not the least little bit, is all derived, all borrowed, all second hand. Even if we come to this conclusion, we haven't really lost anything. We might even say that there's been a very, very great gain in coming to this realization. Last week we said that Zen was concerned with the experience, the direct personal experience, of the living spirit of Buddhism and with the transmission of that spirit from generation to generation. And for Zen, nothing else matters except this. And nothing must be allowed to stand in the way of this experience or this realization. And it's for this reason, on account of this attitude, that Zen is sometimes described as it were, ruthless. Putting aside all the unessential things, all the things which, though useful once upon a time, are now just getting in the way. So that's why we read in the lives of the Zen masters all sorts of strange stories about burning images of the Buddha to keep themselves warm, or tearing up the scriptures, and so on and so forth. just to show us that anything that comes in the way, however traditionally sacrosanct it may be, must be put aside.